Morning. If you turn in your Bible to 2 Kings chapter 2, we're going to be continuing our study of Elijah and Elisha after him as we wrap up the story of Elijah this morning with his ascent into heaven and a couple of scenes here in chapter 2 that I think connect directly with it as Elisha's first few scenes here in the second chapter. In a sense, you could say that Elijah's days have been numbered ever since chapter 19 of 1 Kings. That is, if you remember when he fled from Jezebel and went down all the way to Mount Sinai. And there at Mount Sinai, God gave him the message that the victory is not going to be won in his day, so to speak. Basically, what he says is that you're going to anoint Elisha and he's going to anoint some other people, and that's what's going to take care of this Baal worship problem that's going on. And who one doesn't get, the next will get, and who the next doesn't get, the next will get. But the message ultimately to Elijah, at least on some level, is it's not all going to be taken care of during your day. And so Elijah knows that he's not going to win this battle. His days are numbered. And there's a sense in which this chapter connects with so much of what happened before, because one more time we're going to see fire fall from heaven. This time a fiery chariot is going to come. And so Elijah called fire from heaven at Mount Carmel. He called fire from heaven in chapter 1 to consume the soldiers of Ahaziah. And now fire will come one more time, and this time Elijah will ascend when it descends. And Elisha will become the successor, the true successor, as will be shown in these two scenes at the end of this chapter. So that's kind of where we're going in this chapter, what we're looking at. Let's go ahead and begin by reading some of the text together of 2 Kings chapter 2. Now when the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven by a whirlwind, Elijah and Elisha were on their way from Gilgal. And Elijah said to Elisha, "Please stay here, for the Lord has sent me as far as Bethel." But Elisha said, "As the Lord lives, and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So they went down to Bethel. And the sons of the prophets who were in Bethel came out to Elisha and said to him, "Do you know that today the Lord will take away your master from over you?" And he said, "Yes, I know it. Keep quiet." And Elijah said to him, "Elisha, please stay here, for the Lord has sent me to Jericho." But he said, "As the Lord lives, and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So they came to Jericho. And the sons of the prophets who were at Jericho drew near to Elisha and said to him, "Do you know that today the Lord will take away your master from over you?" And he answered, "Yes, I know it. Keep quiet." Then Elijah said to him, "Please stay here, for the Lord has sent me to the Jordan." But he said, "As the Lord lives, and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So the two of them went on. 50 men of the sons of the prophets also went and stood at some distance from them, as they both were standing by the Jordan. Then Elijah took his cloak and rolled it up and struck the water, and the water was parted to the one side and to the other, till the two of them could go over on dry ground. When they had crossed, Elijah said to Elisha, "Ask what I shall do for you before I am taken from you." And Elisha said, "Please let there be a double portion of your spirit on me." And he said, "You've asked a hard thing. Yet if you see me as I am being taken from you, it shall be so for you. But if you do not see me, it shall not be so." And as they still went on and talked, behold, chariots of fire and horses of fire separated the two of them. And Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. And Elisha saw it, and he cried, my father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen." And he saw him no more. Then he took hold of his own clothes and tore them in two pieces. And he took the cloak of Elijah that had fallen on him and went back and stood on the bank of the Jordan. And he took the cloak of Elijah that had fallen from him and struck the water, saying, "Where is the Lord, the God of Elijah?" And when he struck the water was parted to the one side and to the other, and Elijah went over. Well, this is, I think, to some degree, a familiar scene. It's one of the better-known scenes of the life of Elijah. This, of course, in Mount Carmel as well. But there are a couple of puzzling matters as we consider Elijah's ascent in this whirlwind. There'll be another puzzling matter as we look at the latter portion of this chapter, a couple of puzzling matters there as well. And I don't know that we can determine the answer to all of this, and certainly we don't have time to examine the entire text as exhaustively as we might like to. But one of the questions that immediately comes to my mind as I read this chapter is, why is Elijah trying so hard to leave Elisha behind? what exactly is going on that makes him want to separate himself from Elisha? And again, I don't know that we can come to a definitive answer to that question. You know, whether it's a desire for some privacy in his last hours, or perhaps it's some kind of a test that he is supposed to run Elisha through in order a final confirmation of his dedication. Well, whatever the answer to that may be, one thing is clear when you look at those instances where Elijah says, you know, you stay here, I'm going to go on by myself. What you see clearly is that Elisha is fully committed to Elijah, and more significantly than that, he's fully committed to his calling. In spite of every effort to try to persuade him to stay behind, he follows Elijah all the way that he possibly can. And there is in that, I think, a picture of a level of commitment that we all ought to be striving for. Well, that's not the main point that I want to get at, but that's one of those questions that comes up along the way. One of the other interesting things about these first 14 verses is the trip through the land itself. There are three cities in particular, and then the River Jordan, that are all mentioned specifically: Gilgal, Bethel, Jericho, and then they come to the Jordan River. And what's significant about those cities is that each of them is associated with the very early portions of Israel's arrival in the land and conquest of the land. Gilgal may be one of the lesser known of those, if you don't remember the beginning chapters of Joshua. But in Joshua chapter 5, Gilgal is where they camp when they first enter the land. It's where they circumcise the last of the men that need to be circumcised. It's where they celebrate the first Passover. Jericho, of course, you know very well, is the first victory in the Promised Land. Bethel is closely related with Ai in Joshua chapter 8. And of course, the Jordan River they have to cross in order to get there to begin with. So what you have is a cluster of geographic locations that are immediately recognizable as conquest cities. And I think the significance of that may be to see what's been going on in the Promised Land since then. God's purpose, as you remember, was to punish the Amorites for their iniquity, to drive the idols out of the land, and to give the people of God, the people of the promise, the Israelites, this land. But what's happened since the nation has split, and Jeroboam set up his golden calves, and it's gone on since then until Ahab introduces some of the worst idolatry that the land has ever seen, is basically the people have been turning back the clock. They've been reversing what has supposed to have happened. And it's as bad now as it ever was when God was driving the Amorites out of the land. They've returned the land to the very state of idolatry that God wanted it cleansed from. And just as they have reversed the land, this travel itinerary may be a symbol of that same kind of reversal. And his uncrossing of the Jordan, so to speak, may be a picture that reversal will soon be complete. That just as before they came into the land, they were in captivity, so now they are heading back in that same direction, and they will soon be in captivity again. Now, before that happens, Elisha is going to re-cross that Jordan, and he will begin a work of trying to reconquer the land and bring it back to God. And it's no surprise that Elisha's work will begin in Jericho. Well, a group of people you're introduced in this scene to as well, if you don't remember them from earlier chapters, are the sons of the prophets. This is another group that we don't know a whole lot about. It'd be nice to have more detailed information about these sons of the prophets. Apparently, they're a group of disciples of the prophets. They studied under the prophets, even as John the Baptist had his disciples, and rabbis of all kind had their disciples. The prophets apparently had disciples as well, and we don't know a whole lot about them except that they were there. Some suggest that it was very organized. If you read too many books on the prophets, you'll find talk about there being schools of the prophets, as if it's a very organized kind of thing, and we don't know for sure that may be the case. They certainly seem to have studied under them, but it's really hard to say exactly beyond that what's going on with these sons of the prophets. But it is interesting, if nothing else, where these sons of the prophets are located. The very places that Elijah is going in this itinerary is where you find the sons of the prophets having some of their apparent locations where they would meet together. And two of the cities in particular are striking that they are there. First is Bethel. Bethel, as you remember, is one of the two cities where Jeroboam set up the golden calf. Bethel is where Elisha is going to meet the young men at the end of this chapter who stand in such opposition to him and mock God. And the other city where you find them is Jericho. And you remember, of course, Jericho fell, but you also remember, I presume, that there was a curse on the city of Jericho and on anyone who would rebuild that city. And yet it was rebuilt anyway. And so what you find in Bethel and Jericho are two of the very citadels of opposition to God. And yet in the midst of them you find this group of the sons of the prophets, people who were apparently striving to do God's work in the midst of this opposition. And it's a further picture here that's developed really throughout the Bible, that the calling of God's people is not to hermit ourselves away somewhere, away from the wickedness of the world, but on some level to be right there in the middle of it. Not because we're participating, but because we're doing God's work. And we're trying to be that saving agent to the world, that we are trying to be lights in a dark place. Well, as they are about to part, Elisha makes his request of Elijah that he would receive a double portion of Elijah's spirit. And that may be significant, not only because he wants to continue the work of Elijah, which I think is the more significant part than exactly what a double portion is or what exactly the spirit refers to. It's an idea of him continuing Elijah's work. It's also significant because, as you remember back in chapter 19 of 1 Kings, when Elisha left his life behind, he basically abandoned home and family in order to follow Elijah. He has abandoned his inheritance. The inheritance, of course, of the oldest son was the double portion. And so what Elisha sees as his inheritance, his real calling, his real life, his real connection, his real family, to some degree, is Elijah and that work. And so it's not land that he wants, it's not money that he wants, it's the Spirit, it's Elijah's Spirit that he asks for. And what we'll see as this chapter continues, beginning when he crosses the Jordan on his way back and says, "Where is the Lord, the God of Israel?" And the waters part for him as they had for Elijah. And then continuing on as he purifies the water and then curses the boys at the end of the chapter, what you see is this very thing has happened. He has received the Spirit, as Elijah said that he would. Well, then there is the departure of Elijah itself, where he is taken up to heaven. And the one thing that we can be absolutely sure of is that he was taken to heaven by God. Beyond that, you look at the details and you can kind of wonder exactly how it happened, and I'm not sure that we can say for 100% certainty. I've heard different people debate at different times over what role the different things played as to whether, you know, the chariots arrived just so that they could separate Elijah and Elisha, and that was their only purpose, and he was taken up in a whirlwind by itself, or whether the chariot was taken up in the whirlwind with Elisha or Elijah in it. And frankly, that's really not significant of enough of a matter to spend too much time arguing about. Of all the things in the narrative, that's probably the least important part, is figuring out the exact mode of transportation. The fact that God sends chariots and horses would seem to suggest that they play a part in the transport, since that's what chariots and horses are for. More significantly than that, even, Isaiah 66:15 and Jeremiah 4:13, not talking about this scene specifically, but those passages both make a direct connection between the Lord's chariots and the whirlwind, which would seem to suggest that they do work in some kind of conjunction with one another. But again, that's not the most important part of the story. And what may be even more significant than that, although this, again, is another one of these questions that we can't know for certain what's going on, is what Elisha says when this happens. He says, "My father, my father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen." Well, if you are just reading that by itself, you probably think that what Elisha means is something along the lines of, oh wow, I can see some fiery chariots, or something along those lines, perhaps a little bit more polished than that. But you know the basic idea, that what he's talking about is what he sees there in that very place. Well, the difficulty with this verse is when you get to 2 Kings chapter 13, and you read about the death of Elisha, the wicked Israelite King Joash comes to him in 2 Kings chapter 13 and verse 14. He goes and he weeps before Elisha and he says, my father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen. Well, I don't know for certain, but I hesitate to think that the wicked King Joash is given a vision of the heavenly chariots and horses that he sees as Elisha is about to die. So he must be talking about something different, yet the words are exactly the same in the death scene of Elisha as they are in the translation scene of Elijah. And if we're to understand them as connected in some way, what then is the point of what Elisha is saying? This is going to be hard for me over the next few sermons to get used to saying Elisha. What's the point of what Elisha is saying if it's not just, I can see these fiery chariots? And again, to some degree, I'll leave that with you to think about because I don't know that I have a definitive answer to this question. But let me suggest to you, it may be that what Elisha is talking about and what Joash is talking about later is the symbolic element that the prophet himself plays in the nation of Israel. And what I mean by that is that to some degree, to have the prophet of the Lord on your side is to have the army of the Lord on your side. And you get a more real glimpse of that in 2 Kings chapter 6 when Elisha shows his servant the army of the Lord that stands at ready to rescue Elisha. And so maybe then what Elisha and then Joash are referring to later when they say the chariots of the Lord, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen, maybe what they're referring to is the prophet himself. That they recognize, even the wicked king ultimately recognizes, that the strength of God's power, the strength of Israel's army, is rooted ultimately in God's revelation to His people, and God's messenger to His people, and God's Spirit being on His spokesman. Now again, I can't tell you for certain that that's what's going on, but that may be what's being alluded to here. Well, Elisha then comes back across the river. He has torn his clothes at the departure of Elijah. And that may then help explain what happens next, which is another puzzling kind of scene. In verse 15, when the sons of the prophets who were at Jericho saw him opposite them, they said, "The spirit of Elijah rests on Elisha." And they came to meet him and bowed to the ground before him. And they said to him, "Behold, now there are with your servants 50 strong men. Please let them go and seek your master. It may be that the spirit of the Lord has caught him up and cast him upon some mountain or some valley." And he said, "You shall not send." But when they urged him till he was ashamed, he said, "Send." They sent therefore 50 men, and for 3 days they sought him, but did not find him. And they came back to him while he was staying at Jericho, and he said to them, "Did I not say to you, do not go?" Well, you have these sons of the prophets who will go seeking after Elijah, looking for him on some mountain or some valley. And the puzzle here is, why are they so intent on looking for Elijah? Why don't they just understand that he's gone? And again, I can't tell you for certain that I have the answer to this question, but I think it's helpful to remember that as the readers of this narrative, we are given a privileged perspective that they did not have. In fact, one that nobody had except perhaps Elisha. And that is that we're given the answer at the outset. Just as Elisha knew that Elijah was going to be taken from him, so we're told in verse 1 of this chapter that Elijah was going to be taken to heaven. And then we're told that he is, in fact, taken to heaven. These people, what do they know about it beyond perhaps what Elisha told them, if he told them anything? For all they knew, the Spirit simply took him to another place. And this was a concern at some other point. You remember in chapter 18 of 1 Kings, when Elijah met Obadiah. And Elijah says to Obadiah, "Go get King Ahab and bring him to me." And what Obadiah says is, "What, are you out of your mind? Are you trying to kill me? I'm going to go get him, and the Spirit of the Lord is going to whisk you away to another place." Now, we don't know if that's just Obadiah's supposition of what might happen, or if there's some basis historically for Obadiah knowing that that could happen. But that may be what's going on in their mind now. Maybe the Lord just took him to another place and we need to go find him. On the other hand, it may be that they think that he is dead. If they saw Elisha tearing his clothes, maybe they're looking for a body for burial. Maybe they remember that Moses was taken up on some mountain and you know, maybe we can go find Elijah's body and give it the proper burial that it's due. We can't know for sure. One of the most interesting things as you look at this story and the transition from Elijah to Elisha is what you might call echoes and shadows of different people in the Bible. And it works in a variety of ways. We've talked at the beginning of this series of sermons the similarity between Elijah and Elisha and John the Baptist and Jesus, where you've got Elijah, who is to some degree a lone voice in the wilderness, and Elisha, who sits, more commonly seems to be seen surrounded by disciples and other people. You have Jesus' ministry involving life-giving miracles, even as Elisha's ministry is. Jesus, we're told, in the Gospels came eating and drinking, and Elisha's ministry gives central attention to food and drink. In chapter 2, he will heal the deadly waters. In chapter 4, he'll provide food for the sons of the prophets. In chapter 6, he'll feed the Syrian soldiers who come to capture him. He'll provide food for the city of Samaria when it's besieged. And perhaps in the most direct connection, in chapter 4, he will multiply loaves to feed a multitude. There is very much a sense in the way that Elisha continues the work of Elijah, even as Jesus continued the work of John. But then on the other hand, you could look at them in a perhaps slightly different light, where there is a sense in which Elijah is more like Jesus, and Elisha is more like the Christians that follow. Where you have Elisha, who first leaves home and family and all that he knew to follow Elijah. And then after Elijah's departure, Elisha will receive a measure of the Spirit. And after the ascension of Elijah, he will continue the ministry that Elijah began. And so you might look at the connection in that sense. Or you might look at it in a completely different way. You might consider Elijah and Elisha to be parallel to Moses and Joshua, where Elijah will depart on the far side of the Jordan, even as Moses did. And then Elisha will part the Jordan and enter Palestine to carry on a conquest that begins in Jericho. And there certainly is a linguistic connection there as well, as Elisha and Joshua basically mean the same thing. Elisha means God saves. Joshua means Yahweh saves. And of course, that brings us back to our Jesus connection as well, where Jesus is the Greek form of the same name, Joshua. What I want to spend the rest of our time talking about, and we're starting to run short on it, is the way this chapter ends, which is to show that Elisha is a true prophet. The Elisha really is the continuation of the work of Elijah. The Spirit of God, the Spirit of Elijah, rests on Elisha. And you see this really in two ways. And that is his ability to both bless and curse in the name of the Lord. And to some degree, what you see in the order of the events at the end of this chapter is a foreshadowing of what will come in the ministry of Elisha after this. That Elisha will begin with a gracious and merciful kind of work before he turns his focus to carrying out that commission of anointing those who will take vengeance on the house of Ahab. And you get a hint of that kind of outline for you in these first two scenes. And so we read in verse 19, "Now the men of the city said to Elisha, 'Behold, the situation of the city is pleasant, as my lord sees, but the water is bad and the land is unfruitful.' He said, 'Bring me a new bowl and put salt in it, So they brought it to him. Then he went to the spring of water and threw the salt in it and said, "Thus says the Lord, I've healed this water. From now on, neither death nor miscarriage shall come from it." So the water has been healed to this day according to the word that Elisha spoke. He went up from there to Bethel. And while he was going up on his way, some small boys came out of the city and jeered at him, saying, "Go up, you bald head. Go up, you bald head." And he turned around, and when he saw them, he cursed them in the name of the Lord. And two female bears came out of the woods and tore 42 of the boys. From there, he went to Mount Carmel, and from there he returned to Samaria. Well, there are these two scenes we'll talk about just very briefly. First of all is this picture of him coming to cleanse a bitter spring. And there may be in this a picture of the reversal of that old curse. The Jericho had been cursed, and anyone who rebuilt it had been cursed, and the land was unfruitful, and the water was no good. And now God is reversing that curse. And you get a hint of, again, what is a much bigger biblical picture of the graciousness of God in spite of people's failings. The graciousness of God to relent on His curse in order to spare His people. And notice also that Elisha and God as well will use the means that the people supplied. He allows them to, in some degree, to be a part of their own salvation, which I think is a way of strengthening their faith by allowing them to participate in God's cleansing. The other scene here is the one I want to spend more time on, if you'll bear with me, because it's the one that gets a lot of bad press from skeptics. This is one of those scenes where people look at it and they say, you know, how can you worship a God who will do something like this? How can you trust God and have faith in God if He'll send bears out of the woods to kill little children? And in that light, this scene, it needs closer examination. So as you consider this scene, it's very often depicted as, you know, this crotchety old prophet who's as short on humor as he is on hair. That's kind of the way that it's described by these skeptics. And is that really what's going on, or is there more to the scene than just a grouchy old man who doesn't like being made fun of? Well, as you look at the elements of this story, I think it kind of becomes clear that it's not just that. First of all, the fact that they're described as small boys, the translation I'm reading from says, is not necessarily the best understanding of the words that are used there. Now, these words have a pretty wide semantic range. They can mean any number of different things. And so, you know, we can't say for certain, but we do know that the word boys is the word youths or something along those lines. The range of this word in the Old Testament, not only does it include small children, but also it includes young men who are in military service in 1 Kings chapter 20. It's the word that's used to describe Isaac in Genesis chapter 22 when he's old enough to carry all the wood for a burnt offering up a mountain. It's the word that's used to describe Joseph in Genesis 37 when he is 17 years old. And so don't necessarily think that you have a bunch of 10-year-olds, you know, playing Ring Around the Rosie in this scene. It could be a pretty wide range. One writer I was reading said it could be anywhere between 12 and 30. I think that might be stretching the top end a little bit. But even if you're talking about 15, 16, 17, 18-year-olds, it puts a completely different look on this scene. The word small that's used here in the translation I'm reading from, it's the word that's used of David when he is called the youngest of his brothers. Although he's big enough to be tending sheep all on his own and big enough to go fight against Goliath in battle. And so again, we can't say exactly from the words themselves what it must mean, but don't necessarily think that it means that you've got a bunch of little kids running around in this scene. Secondly, I think it's helpful to realize that there's a mob of them. It's not like five kids who are laughing at his bald head. After he calls the bears out of the woods, the bears get 42 of them, which means there were more than 42 if it got 42 of them. I don't know how many there were, but let's say there were 43. and let's say that they're 17 or 18 years old, and they're mocking the prophet of God, this again, this isn't, you know, a half dozen 10-year-olds playing Ring Around the Rosie. This is a gang of, you know, a teenage street gang really is, I think, a better picture of what's going on here. But what about this crotchety old prophet? Well, probably he's not a crotchety old prophet to begin with. I don't know if he's crotchety or not. That's outside of our point. But I'd suggest to you he probably wasn't very old. And the reason I would suggest that is we know that Elisha works through the reigns of four different kings. And if we take it to the absolute minimum and we say that he began his work on the last day of the first king's reign and he died on the first day of the last king's reign, he still would minister for another 45 years after this point. Up to 62 or 63 if you take the longer view of when he started and ended in those king's reigns. So he's probably not a very old prophet at this point. Again, we can't say for sure, but I'd be surprised if he was much more than 30 when this happened. And whether or not he was bald is another question, which, you know, we say, well, why does that matter? Well, you know, making fun of someone's baldness in our culture is a common form of humor. That's just what people do. They laugh at people who are bald. Not necessarily rightfully so, but it's what's done in our culture. Well, that's not the way it was then. It's not a joke in that culture. It's a source of scorn in their culture. In fact, baldness was extremely rare. It's so rare that there has never been an archaeological discovery that's shown a depiction of any bald people in it ever. And if he was young as well, that would probably further strengthen the fact that he wasn't bald. Well, you do find baldness in the Old Testament, though. It's associated with leprosy in Leviticus chapter 13. And it's associated with God cursing people in Isaiah chapter 3. And again, that could kind of put a different spin on this scene, where they're not making fun of a natural state of his being, but they're just hurling at him insults of utter contempt, whether or not he was bald. And again, you put it back in the mouths of a teenage street gang, and it's not the scene that the skeptics would have you see. One other thing about this is the fact that they tell him to go up. I don't think they're saying, go up the hill on your merry little way. This is directly in the context of Elijah's ascent into heaven. In fact, the same basic phrase is used when it says Elijah went up into heaven. Surely the story has gotten around. And now as he gets to Bethel, this place of hostility toward God, they're hurling insults at Elisha, and they're mocking his God when they say, why don't you blast off on up to heaven as well? Well, what happens is exactly what God promised would happen. In the reading that Brian did for us before the sermon, God tells them that he is going to punish them when they don't listen. And God tells them a variety of ways that he will punish them, and it will get worse, and it will get worse, and it will get worse, and it will get worse. And one of the first levels of that punishment we read in Leviticus chapter 26 was that God is going to stop the rain and the crops will not grow. That sounds familiar in the Elijah story, doesn't it? We went through the famine and the drought at the beginning of Elijah's life. Well, what comes after that? As God says, I will send the wild beasts out of the forest, and they will bereave you of your children. And Elisha curses the young boys, and two bears come out of the woods and kill 42 of them. But what's the purpose of those judgments in Leviticus chapter 26? It's not God unleashing his hostility against his people. The point of every one of those is to bring his people back to him. Until it gets to the point where God cannot take it anymore and he completely destroys his people. Every judgment before that point is designed to bring them back. And that's what this is as well. It's one more reminder of who is in charge. And with it, it's a stamp again on Elisha that he is a man who bears the Spirit of God, that just as Elijah calls fire from heaven to consume the soldiers, and just as God unleashes lions against disobedient people in 1 Kings 13, so also now Elisha has that ability to call bears from the forest against those who mock God. And so the question that this chapter asks to some degree is the same question the last chapter asked, which is God in the land or isn't He? You remember that was the question of chapter 1. And so that's the question that continues. Elijah is gone now. Is God still here? And the answer in these final two scenes is, yes, He is. And not only is He here, He is still pleading with you to come back to Him. When you get to 2 Chronicles chapter 36, however, you find the end of the story. And it's one you know well, and it's not terribly happy. 2 Chronicles chapter 36, verse 15, we read about God continuing to plead. The Lord, the God of their fathers, sent persistently to them by His messengers, because He had compassion on His people and on His dwelling place. But they kept mocking the messengers of God, despising His words and scoffing at His prophets, until the wrath of the Lord rose against His people, until there was no remedy. Well, you read a chapter like Leviticus chapter 26, and it sounds incredibly depressing. And it sounds like a stark contrast from a song like Joyful, Joyful, We Adore Thee. And it is a little bit of a downer, perhaps, to read that right after that song. On the other hand, it is God's graciousness continued. God's punishments, God's discipline, is a measure of God's grace. Or it's a measure of His punishment, depending on how we react. If we heed it, it is God's grace. If we ignore it, we are only asking for more punishment, like the Israelites did and the Judeans did. And as we read in our class this morning, the Lord is not slow concerning His promises. He's patient. He wants all of us to come to repentance. And so to some degree, the message is still the same today. Is God in the land or isn't He? Is God going to judge or won't He? Is God going to return or won't He? Well, the answer is, to all of those questions, yes. He is here. He is in control. He is going to judge. He is going to return. The only real question is, which side are we on? And when God sends lesser judgments our way, will we listen to them? And so we offer an invitation this morning to anyone who is in a position that they need to make something right in their lives. Whether you need to become a part of God's kingdom for the very first time, or if you are a fallen soldier and you need to make something right in your life. If there's any way that we can help you, won't you come while we stand and sing?